welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security, and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Now, I've got a little bit of announcement to make. This will actually be the last regular episode of the podcast. I'll have more to say about that. I'm going to do a special little episode after this one to announce what's coming next and close out the show properly. But this will be the last regular interview that I do on the Managing Violence Podcast. And I'm so delighted that it is with journalist Amanda Ripley. Amanda has written some incredible books, but the book we're talking about today is High Conflict, which is a great read for anyone who is interested in making the world better and more peaceful and managing the violence and aggression that is around us. The book High Conflict deals with conflict management, but not just in everyday conflict, but also primarily around what we call high conflict, which is the left versus right, black versus white, nation versus nation, gang versus gang, identity, politics, that polarizing conflict that just seems to be so toxic that consumes people and destroys relationships and communities. That's what high conflict is all about. And this is a fantastic conversation if you're interested in the topic. So without further ado, here is Amanda Ripley. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by journalist and author Amanda Ripley. Amanda, thank you so much for making the time to join us.
Thank you for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
Look, it's been, you've been on my list of guests that I've wanted to get for at least 18 months now. Whenever I first read your book, High Conflict, I was just saying to you, it came up as a recommendation for me on Amazon, and I looked at it and I thought, that's exactly my jam. I need to get that. And I wasn't disappointed. Really, really well-written book. I always love when, I say this to a few authors I've had on the podcast, I love when non-violence people write books that are relevant to us, because when a proper author writes a book, you can tell the difference to when it's a subject matter expert who's trying to become an author. And I think it makes the whole read so much better. You don't realize the difference in quality sometimes when someone who's a professional writer tends to write stuff. So thank you for taking an interest in our niche.
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank you for, I think there's value in coming at things from an expert point of view, and there's also value at having a little distance from it. And there's pros and cons, right? There's trade-offs, but I'm grateful that despite my not being a formal expert, the book was still useful to you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the thing I love about the book is the investigative tone that you take and interviewing people that are experts in conflict or have lived through conflict, especially high conflict, which we'll get into in a second, and how that differs from healthy conflict, how they've resolved it, what are the lessons they learned, rather than positioning yourself as an expert, which I think is, at the end of the day, makes the book so strong because you get so many different viewpoints from people in different stages of life, different demographics and so on, which I won't spoil the book, but obviously go buy the book if you're intrigued already. Certainly by the end, I'm sure we'll see a couple of book sales. So let's go with that. So just to start off, Amanda, if you could just tell us, what is high conflict? How does that differ from regular conflict or healthy conflict?
Yeah, so high conflict, sometimes people, researchers call it intractable conflict or even malignant conflict. I like the phrase high conflict for various reasons, one of which is it sounds less impossible than intractable. But high conflict is the kind of conflict that we're seeing a lot of today. So it's what happens when conflict escalates to a point where it sort of takes on a life of its own. And in that state, we behave differently. We believe ourselves or our group to be morally superior. We make a ton of mistakes. We literally lose our peripheral vision, figuratively and literally. And the worst part is that people in high conflict, it's always the same in every case I've studied. They end up damaging the thing they care most about, whether it's their family or their country or whatever it is, the thing they actually went into the fight to protect ends up getting harmed.
There's so many little pieces of what you just said that I want to pull on threads about, but I'm sure we'll get there. I am intrigued though. What made you want to write about this subject? Because you weren't a conflict professional to begin with. You're a journalist. What made this idea of conflict something that was topical for you that you really wanted to dive into?
Well, I only recently realized, although it should have been obvious, but I only recently realized that all the books I've written have come about because I've been working on something as a reporter and just kind of hit a wall where things just weren't, I just couldn't keep telling the same story. It wasn't offering me any hope personally, and it also didn't seem that useful. So the first book I wrote was about human behavior in disasters. So in terrorism or hurricanes, all kinds of disasters, because I was covering that for Time Magazine. And I just kind of got to a point where it felt like there was something missing. And in this case, it was the voices and stories and insights of survivors. So the trick for me personally and professionally was find people who have been through the woods and out the other side and tell their stories and try to learn from them rather than just, you know, grieving alongside them, which is also important. But, it seemed like there was a lot of grieving and lamenting and not a lot of learning. So that was my first book. And then I did it again on education, where, again, I hit a brick wall. It just seemed like the conflict around education in the States was really kind of suffocating. And so I went, followed American teenagers to schools with countries with higher performing education systems for a year. And, as they went to high school, learned from what they noticed and what they experienced. And then, I was covering political polarization, among other things. And it just felt like, 6 or 7 years ago, journalism was no longer working the way it was supposed to, at least here in the States. And the conflict in politics was so overwhelming. It had become a high conflict, right, which I now know, that any intuitive thing I might do as a journalist was going to make things worse or have no impact at all, which was the most likely outcome, neither of which was super satisfying. So I basically just stopped what I was doing and spent a couple of years following two kinds of people, people who understand conflict intimately, like yourself, but differently from journalists, right? People like negotiators or gang violence interrupters or divorce lawyers, people who understand what happens to humans when they get into high conflict. And then also the second group was people who have been really stuck in miserable high conflicts, whether they're in politics or activism or, an ugly divorce or even in civil war or gangs, and then shifted into what I like to think of as good conflict, which is the kind of conflict that makes us stronger rather than destroying us. So that was, again, my attempt to try to find something useful to say in the noise that felt to me mostly uninteresting at a certain point around political polarization.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And as you mentioned, I mean, this idea of healthy conflict, I mean, we can't have no conflict or else it just means that someone's always getting their way and no one's ever speaking up, right? That's the only way to completely avoid conflict is to never speak up for anything, right. which is really toxic as well. So I think having that healthy, the healthy conflict is super important. But this high conflict where it becomes moral and indignant and this cognitive dissonance sets in, even though it may not necessarily be violent, it's, I think the term you use in the book is it's very highly flammable, right? And we see that when their identity is attached to a conflict, then almost anything becomes palatable as an action. And certainly you don't have to be a student of human history to know that's resulted in not just homicides and massacres, but genocide and unspeakable human behaviors over millennia. So it's a topic we really need to understand. But as you say, I think the last, at least from my observation anyway, the last 10 years, it seems to have just ramped up exponentially. And a lot of people point fingers at the media, and we'll circle back to that towards the end of the conversation about what role the media has to play in this. But just the level, I think just the variety of news sources, the variety of reporting sources that someone can choose to listen to or not listen to, and the idea that we can invalidate an entire multi-billion-dollar network because of our perceived, our perception of where they sit on a continuum of my beliefs or not on my beliefs, and therefore everything else they say is false. I mean, that idea is just like unreal compared to the rest of our history of journalism and media. But I would love to unpack that a little bit further later on. So I guess probably the first big question I have for you is, how do these conflicts that sometimes may start off as a difference of opinion or a could have been healthy conflict, how do they turn into this good versus evil moral judgment? Like, how does that happen?
Right. That was like the central mystery I was trying to solve, right? Is why, I mean, there's a lot of conflicts that do not metastasize in this way, right? Most. And when you look at the ones that do become high conflicts, it's not obvious on their face why. So in following people who have been through this or who are immersed in conflict or study conflict, I was looking for, you know, the tripwires. What are the reliable predictors that turn conflict into this kind of toxic brew? And I identify four of them. There are probably more, and your listeners may have thoughts on that. You may have thoughts on that. So, but in every high conflict I looked at all around the world, these four were present to different degrees. So one of them is the presence of false binaries. So categories of humans are always sorting each other into categories, right? Like that's something that we just are wired to do. We're groupish, as they say, and we like groups and we have a bias for our own group. And that's, you know, the way it is. But the problem seems to arise when there's a false sense of certainty about each other. And mostly when you just have two groups and everybody's sorted into us or them, right? And then you start to get into this sort of moral hierarchy of who is inherently better. And soon you find yourself generalizing about millions of people you'll never meet, which is always dangerous. So that kind of artificial separation of people into morally inferior and superior groups is definitely one of the tripwires. As Curtis Toler, who's the former gang leader I featured in the book, as he said, and I often think of this when I'm writing about politics, but he said, you know, anytime there's a better than and a less than, there's always room for war. And I think that's right. So the problem isn't groups, right? It's that kind of superiority and inferiority. So then the second thing beyond this false binary is the presence of conflict entrepreneurs. So conflict entrepreneurs are people or companies that systematically incite and inflame and exploit conflict for their own ends. You know, people who seem to delight in every twist and turn the conflict takes, who really feed it and inflame it. We all can be conflict entrepreneurs. I know it's very easy to be one as a journalist, especially today. Anyone on social media is strongly incentivized to be a conflict entrepreneur at this point. So this is an important one to be aware of for ourselves and for others. But this is something that you see even in, you know, really ugly divorces. There's often somebody just outside the couple who's kind of inflaming the conflict. And this can be a lawyer in some cases, or it can be a sister-in-law. I mean, it's hard to predict, but it's important to know, to notice that, right? And if possible, distance yourself from the conflict entrepreneurs in your orbit or on your feed. And then the third thing, which I think is maybe the most intriguing and least appreciated factor that leads to high conflict, is humiliation. So humiliation, right, is the sort of forced lowering of someone, usually publicly, or your group, where you feel like, again, going back to this sense of hierarchy, that you were brought low, disrespected in some kind of public way. And Evelyn Lindner, who, you know, studies conflict all over the world, she has said that humiliation is the nuclear bomb of the emotions. And I think that's right. You see it just laced into interviews with perpetrators and victims of all kinds of violence. Anytime people feel humiliated, it lights up their brain much the way physical pain does. And of course, even if their group gets humiliated, not them, someone in their group, they feel it, it lights up their brain in the same way as if it were pain happening to them. So that's, I think, a really interesting one that is often never mentioned. You know, when you read about international diplomatic standoffs or even war, if you listen to Putin's last speech before the invasion of Ukraine, it's all about humiliation. So it's this really important factor that I think it makes the inexplicable explicable in high conflict. And then the last one is corruption. So when people feel that institutions cannot be trusted to do what they're supposed to do, then they will tend to take matters into their own hands. And that is another way, that deep distrust, right, is another way to get into a cycle, a sort of spiral of contempt, disgust, then violence and high conflict.
Yeah, there is, you can literally apply all four of those to a lot of situations. Like I'm thinking just from the last couple of years here in Australia, I know I made the US media cycle about our lockdowns, and I'm living in Melbourne, which was the world's most locked down city. It's now a badge of pride for us. But we went from most livable city in the world to most locked down city in the world in 2 years. So it was an interesting transition. But we had months of people taking to the streets and protests, and you know, protesting was illegal for a period in time because of the mass gathering factor. And that, of course, if you start ticking boxes, I mean, the group identities of the vaxxers and anti-vaxxers or pro-state, anti-state, that developed really, really strongly. And then when you've got police on the street essentially firing rubber bullets at people that are peacefully protesting because they're failing to disperse, then it becomes, well, obviously the state is turned against us, so therefore corruption has crept in. You absolutely had this massive pool of fire starters and conflict entrepreneurs on the side that were trying to make something dramatic happen for their live stream or for their clickbait headlines, because it only takes one, you know, 3 second clip of video, one animated GIF to go viral, and you're there, right? And then the humiliation, because as part of the mandates, I mean, people that had chosen not to be vaccinated for a time were not allowed into buildings, were not allowed into shops, were not allowed to go to a cafe. So there was an element of segregation that made people feel humiliated that perhaps if they go out with their friends that are vaccinated, they get left outside like a pet. All of that tied in together, and we're still seeing, I mean, look, I won't go into COVID policy here, but I mean, we ended up with something like 94% fully vaccinated population, but mostly, partially because of how difficult it was to be unvaccinated in the country. Mm. But all of that to say, I mean, that the scars of that, even with the people that did choose to get vaccinated, they considered to be under duress because they had to work. We're still seeing those comments being made. We're still seeing that indignation and that anger festering and a complete distrust of the state. And that's really difficult to navigate. And it's hard to know, like, where does that end? You know, it's not like that's going to stop with this generation, because that person is going to pass on those messages to others and to their children. And where does that eventually lead us to? So yeah, right. lots of interesting stuff. Yeah.
I think that's a great example. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and even just think, like, even at a very, very micro scale, talking about things like youth crime, for example, you know, it could just be two young guys that get into an argument, one's happy to walk away, but then the fire starter or the conflict entrepreneur beside him says, are you really going to let him talk to you like that? And now that you've kind of brought the humiliation to the surface, and you've created an us versus them. And now we've got a stupid fight that didn't need to happen, probably from someone who didn't even really want to be in a fight, but now feels like they have to. All these bits and pieces. You know, I always, my angle on conflict socially is that it's usually triggered by either disrespect or disempowerment. So those are the two pieces, but they connect very tightly into what you just said there. So I'd love to talk a little bit more about that humiliation at the macro scale. Because I know that there's so many beautiful case studies that you've used in the book, everything from guerrilla warfare and resistance fighters to activism to gang violence. Which is the one that you think is probably most interesting to unpack from a humiliation and lowering of status point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the politics one might be interesting to talk about, because you don't immediately think about humiliation. For this book, I followed a conflict expert named Gary Friedman, who's a mediator here in the States. He's worked all over the world. He teaches negotiation at Harvard and Stanford, one of the wisest people I know when it comes to conflict. I got mediation training from him myself, which is how I met him. And I've read his books. And then a few years ago, some of his neighbors asked him to run for local office in his small town of Northern California, because even there, their meetings had gotten so toxic and there was just so much us versus them framing, even in this little town on this volunteer, you know, town council, essentially. And so they figured, who better to right the ship than Gary? And so he said, okay, he would run for office, and he won in a landslide and ousted a couple of people who'd been, he and his allies ousted a couple of people who'd been on the board for a very long time. And they vowed to do things very differently, have a very different tone, be much more inclusive. Gary is exceptionally gifted at listening in ways that you can see. And so he was doing that practice and meetings and all these things. But as he put it, it took him about an eighth of a second before he got sucked into high conflict himself, despite everything he knew about conflict. And so, you know, by his own telling, he lost 2 years of his peace of mind to this conflict. He became someone he was not proud of. He did things, acted as a conflict entrepreneur in some cases. And a lot of that, once he was able to kind of sit back and reflect on what was happening after 2 years, he realized that a lot of it was that he felt humiliated, you know, that he had felt like he was doing this huge favor to his little town when he could be out, you know, lecturing and writing books. And he was, you know, bequeathing his life's work on this little town. And so it was not stated, but to him, it felt like if he couldn't make it work in this little town, then his whole 40 years of conflict mediation were for nothing, right? So that became a very high stakes test. And his ego got very involved. And politics, even at the local level, at least here in the States, is now designed to create high conflict. There's two sides. All the language is adversarial. There's a lot of like demonizing of the other side. And he and his political advisor at the time did a lot of that. It's a way to kind of psych yourself up, right? Get kind of rally the troops and get people motivated to vote for you. But then you have to actually govern. And now you have a group of people that you have ostracized. And we know that, so they too felt humiliated, right? By the way that he had come in and dismissed them in their mind. So there's a great quote by Nelson Mandela where he says, there's no one more dangerous than one who's been humiliated, even when you humiliate him rightly, which I love. I love that last little addendum. So even if Gary was right that they had not done a good job, which I'm not sure he was, but in some ways he was definitely right, then it didn't matter because he was actually creating humiliation, which was working against his own ends. Like he just couldn't get anything done. And eventually there was a move to oust him and there was just a lot of conflict and it was just miserable. And his wife wanted to move out of the neighborhood. And, you know, so that's just a small example of how humiliation can work on conflict without anyone ever really acknowledging it. And I think that's sort of the norm.
Yeah, I mean, always the thing I liked about Gary's story in your book was that it forced him to act so out of character. Things that he would never have consciously decided to do suddenly became like obvious to him. I should do this, or I should sabotage this, or I should conspire against this. And this is a guy who literally has written the book on conflict management. And it's we're so hilariously fallible as human beings.
Right. That's what it taught me. Because I was like, if Gary can fall for this, then I'm definitely susceptible to this, you know?
Yeah. Let alone someone who's, you know, taking their entire worldview from what they're seeing on social media or what they're seeing on their, you know, their newsfeed one way or another. You almost can't be mad at people because there's so much going on. We have access to so much information. It's really hard to have an informed opinion about everything. Mm-hmm. Right? At a certain point, you have to just go, I trust that source. I'll go with that because I don't have time to research every different angle on this. And when our whole, I guess the economic or the commercial side of media, whether it's social media or conventional media, is based upon clicks and retaining attention, it's always going to be the most dramatic stuff. It's going to be the stuff that makes you feel something. And if you feel humiliated, you'll still click on it because you want to know who this person is that's humiliating you, right?
Right. It registers
take away your rights.
Yeah, it registers as a threat, right, which we're wired to react to. So I don't think we've caught up. We could design platforms to do something different, right? And it's not that hard. But we haven't sort of caught up with our own psychology, if that makes sense, right? So I don't think, even though, yes, we are wired to sort of be hyper-vigilant about threats, and that's being exploited right now, I don't think it has to be this way. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it would take people being prepared to sacrifice some income for a while.
Yes, that's true.
To build a new system.
That's true.
It's really hard to swallow for a publicly traded company.
Yeah, right.
So, hey guys, we're not going to actually grow. In fact, we're going to retract for the next 10 years while we do this socially responsible thing.
I don't think that can't be the argument. It can't be do this thing because right thing. But there are companies if you look at LinkedIn, right? LinkedIn is much less toxic than, say, Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. Now they're different, right? They do different things. But LinkedIn isn't doing that because it's socially responsible, right? There's a set of norms and incentives that have been developed over time. And there are other sites like this. If I need to replace the flapper in my toilet to get it to flush correctly, I can immediately get a bunch of people on various sites giving me really good advice, right? With decency and respect and good humor and grace. These same people, if I brought up politics on a different site, we might get into some kind of ridiculous beef, right? But so I do think there's different cultures that you can cultivate on purpose, but you're right. You can't do it if the only reason to do it is because it's socially responsible. There has to be a business model behind it. And I think that's possible, but that's maybe a little ways out. Yeah.
Yeah. I almost feel like it has to be a new actor in the space that comes in with that model and then gets traction with it before, rather than someone changing something that's working obscenely well for them.
I agree. So, yeah, anyway, exactly.
That becomes a business decision. I'm also interested in the role of the conflict entrepreneur at the state level, because certainly with what I do as a security consultant, we're always looking for, to be able to create disharmony within a group. It disempowers the group very quickly, or at least distracts the group. And there's some evidence that as early as 1996, Osama bin Laden was talking about making America turn upon itself by baiting them into a long, exhausting war. Mm-hmm. Is a conflict entrepreneur. How do we make this great power turn on itself?
Yeah,
as opposed absolutely. To we can't destroy America through a couple of terrorist attacks, but we might be able to bait them into something they can't get out of. And we look at the actions of the People's Republic of China and infiltration, and the Russians infiltrating and planting false flags and media stories and so on. Bot farms and all that kind of crazy stuff that just makes people feel like, hey, my weird idea is actually being supported by these 15,000 random accounts that have no history. So I'm not alone. In fact, I'm actually the majority. I am legion. This whole idea, it's not just about the one person on the side of a divorce. It can actually be an entire state or an espionage strategy. So
absolutely. Yeah, I'm amazed. I was just reading a report on, some recent investigations into Russian efforts to exploit existing fissures in the United States, especially racial fissures, right, which is our oldest fissure. And it's so easy to do. And it's just, reading what they were doing, you have two reactions. One is anger, right, because it's so obvious how we're being manipulated. But the second is, I'm amazed they're still doing it, because we're doing it to ourselves so effectively that they really don't have
to. The snowball's already rolling downhill.
It's now on automatic, right? It's just a perpetual motion machine. And I don't think they started it. They've been doing it for a very long time. If you look back at HIV, right, it was, there was disinformation that foreign agents spread in the United States about how the US government had invented AIDS, right, in order to kill Black people, right? And this, I remember when I was reporting on covering the city of DC in the 90s, many, many people believed this in Washington, you know, especially Black people who had good reason to distrust the government. So, you know, this is an old story, but now it does feel like we're doing it for them, right? We're doing it to each other. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's almost like once you sort of just give it a nudge in the right direction, it just the population that you're actually targeting will just run with it.
Yeah.
Like, well, that suits my narrative. That explains things that I haven't previously been able to explain.
Right.
You know, it's almost like, it's like when our first ancestors did a dance and it started raining, like, well, dancing causes rain.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Like that's
Very vulnerable to it, right? Like the more insecurity and distrust, the more vulnerable a population is. It's amazing.
And the more complex the world gets, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The more we want to have an easy answer. And if someone presents us an easy answer that also, you know, speaks to our biases and our sense of indignant rage, it's also an idea. This is tangentially connected to your book, but I'd love to get your take on it. I've had this theory that in the absence of something real to fight about, humans will turn the banal into something serious, right? Uh-huh. Like if we haven't had an existential, well, you could argue COVID was the closest we've come to a really big sort of existential threat in modern times, you know, for our generation. But it's like we'll find these little things that become life and death battles because it's almost like we're hardwired to have something to fight against. And we've had it so good for the last 70 years that it's like, we need to create something. Like we need to build something.
Yeah, I think
I'm not sure what this part of our DNA.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think it also is like, I would just add to it maybe and say, you know, in the absence of something real to fight about and in the presence of fear, anxiety, and uncertainty and isolation, people will find a proxy battle, right? So in other words, there is real like sense of dislocation because of the pace of change, because of the inundation of information in the news and other formats. And I think that does create a sort of low level anxiety in everyone to different degrees. And we know people are more isolated and lonely in lots of ways. We're not kind of living the way we have through most of human evolution, right? In family networks. And so that creates this unease. But one thing we've learned, which always fascinates me, one thing we've learned about the human brain is that we are very good at knowing something's wrong. Like something's bothering us. We can notice that, but we are horrible at interpreting why. And I definitely include myself in this, right? Like maybe I'll be really pissed off about some small thing and I'll realize if I have the presence of mind to step back, that what I'm really upset about is that I'm starving. Like I'm really hungry. I miss lunch. Do you know what I mean? But it's so convincing when you're in that mindset, right? Like I am sure that something, you know, is somebody else's fault. And then I'm like, well, let me just have a sandwich and see how I feel about it. And you feel totally differently. So that's a ridiculous example, but you see what I'm getting at. Like
My wife does the same thing. Like I'll see her stewing. I'm like, I'm gonna go get you lunch. And like, you're not angry. You're hangry, right?
Yeah.
You need to have some food, and you'll be fine.
Yeah, so all these people are hangry, or you know, so to speak, because of different reasons, and then a bunch of conflict entrepreneurs are raised up, and they offer them an explanation. You know, it's these people. These people are trying to destroy you. These people hate your country. These people hate you. I mean, that has now become totally normal on, you know, US news cable channels. It's just amazing. Like that, you know, Americans hate blank is the new kind of slogan for a lot of pundits and influencers. And it's really dangerous.
Yeah, it's... Well, that probably leads us to a nice sort of last section, which is how do we fix this? Like what do we do about this? How do we create? I think the term you use is a conflict infrastructure. Yeah, how do we build an environment that isn't it's not receptive to high conflict, or at least it's able to identify the beginning stages of high conflict, and we can step back from it. And I know there's things we can do as individuals. Do you have thoughts on both the individual level and also things we can do societally? to sort of make this less, there's a word that's not coming to me, but basically make it make an environment that's not quite as rich in conflict.
Right. Well, some of that, you know, depends on the place and the time. I mean, here in the States, which obviously is the place I know the best, one of the things that we should do, and a lot of people are trying to do, is to have more than two political parties, so we're not falling into this trap of us versus them quite as easily, and also have proportional representation so that, you know, we don't split everything. You know, right now, if Democrats lose, Republicans win, and vice versa. And so there's this really adversarial, primitive approach to dealing with our problems. And so we just can't get anything done. But in other systems, you know, there are plenty of problems, right, all over the world, even if you have 15 parties. But there's some evidence that you have less polarization if, you know, if you can have ranked choice voting and other ways that kind of complicate those binaries, right, that mix up the groups a little bit. And then, you know, one of the things that I've been talking to members of Congress about and trying to be helpful to them about is just how they do their business. I mean, one of the things that I'm writing about this week is a committee in Congress that has managed to get more done than almost any other, despite being evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. And part of what they do is just spend more time together. So that is, that does feel like, oh, that's an individual thing, but it's some things, you know, are both. They're like systems design macro changes, and they're also interpersonal changes. And in that case, you know, they sit in their committee hearing rooms, Democrat, Republican, as opposed to on opposite sides of the room. Sounds like a small thing, but anything you can do to make it harder to dehumanize each other is going to help you, right? And we know from, there've been more than 500 experiments all over the world on what's called intergroup contact theory, right? So if people spend time together under the right conditions, it is harder for them to dehumanize each other. And they just have to see the complexity. So you just can't generalize about each other the way that, that you want to. So I think some of what we could do is involves big institutions helping us get there, including journalism, helping us know each other better, helping us hold more complexity in our heads, and also turning down the volume on conflict entrepreneurs. So I just wrote a story last week about a group that has created an index for scoring the rhetoric of politicians on a scale of 1 to 8, based on how much contempt or dignity they're showing their opponents in their language. So this is a small effort to try to incentivize decency, because right now there are a lot of incentives for contempt, right? But if you could get political funders and voters to care about that, right, or something like it, then politicians would notice because they're very receptive to those signals. You know, those are some of the things that are most on my mind right now. What do you think? I mean, what do you think would have to change?
Yeah, look, I think I'm sort of pulling back to the personal level, but the story that really resonates with me out of your book, and I think the terminology used is, I took a note, complicating the narrative, right? Like it's not as binary. There's real human beings. We all make mistakes. We all started off the same. We might have gone in different directions, but you know, there's all these different factors that have gone into it. And the story of, I think it was Curtis's story, where there was the shooting and then there was this lifelong hatred for this guy who shot a friend, and now this has become a vendetta for life. And then it turns out that the guy didn't even mean to shoot anybody. It was a terrible decision, and he's lived with the guilt his whole life, and now he's been hated this whole time. And really, they end up becoming friends at the end. Which I won't spoil the story. Go read the book. It's fantastic. But there's so much to that of just complicating the narrative by accepting that we're all humans and that sometimes your immediate reaction to someone is not, or your immediate interaction with someone is not representative of who they are as a person. It's them at that moment on that day having the worst day of their life, you know, whatever. And we can build a judgment and then a whole narrative around that judgment. And just as a really silly example, I had this just recently. I'm currently back doing part-time study, working towards an MBA, and I was in a classroom, and this. It's a fairly sort of prestigious business school here, and it's a part-time program. So pretty much everybody that's there is a high-performing executive manager of somewhere else, right? So it's a lot of type A personalities in one room who are used to being in charge, and everybody's the same. So it's an interesting melting pot. And there was one particular colleague, and I hope he's not listening to the episode because he'll identify himself immediately. there's one particular colleague in the room who, in the first 3 months we're together, I just really didn't like him. I thought he was condescending. I thought he was talking over people. He was answering questions that were asked at the lecture. It's just things I was like, dude, like, just get back in your box. And then it wasn't until the second term that we were together, and we had a lecturer that did we're talking about individual personality differences in teams, and he did this little exercise where we essentially had to score ourselves against the big five personality traits, and then we had to line up in the room in order against these five personality traits. And the guy that I didn't like had almost identical scores in every metric to me. And I realized that I was like, we're the same person. Do I not like you because you have the same traits as me? It's like this kind of really weird sort of epiphany that I was like, maybe things I don't like about you are actually things I don't like about myself.
Yeah.
And we're friends now. We after that, we started having a dialogue. I'm like, I actually like you. You're pretty cool. And I feel like in my perception is he's toned it down a little bit, but it could actually be that I've just like got over my initial judgment of him. It's just a really silly, like, we're never going to end up in a fist fight in the car park, but it's just a little silly conflict that was in my head until I realized that he was actually just like me, even though we come from different parts of the world and have vastly different life experiences. So yeah. I think complicating that narrative and creating environments where we can hear different viewpoints and understand why people come to different viewpoints. And I think politics is a difficult place for that to happen sometimes, because the very nature of being a career politician does separate you a little bit from the average human experience. And I think by the time you've got to a point where you're old enough and experienced enough and arguably jaded and compromised enough to be an elected official, it might be a little bit harder to unpack that. But I think certainly at that individual level, and you mentioned Gary's story about being on boards, if you want to see conflict, just go to any volunteer board. Every board I've ever been part of, there is more conflict than anyone getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. Volunteers are the worst. Speaking as one,
right?
Anyway, so to round out, I think there's some great stuff there. Like, we need to humanize problems. We need to complicate narratives. Stop thinking so binary. I think be aware of the fact that we didn't even get into tar pits, but being aware when we're stuck in the tar pit, when we're being drawn into this conflict, even though it's not in our best interest, but there's no rational reason why you would still be there, but you can't not reply to that comment on YouTube because it's just so wrong. Those are the things I think we really have to be aware of. I just want to close on a couple of minutes just regarding your work with the media on conflict and how we report on high conflict, whether you have any particular thoughts. I know you definitely do, but just sort of short form thoughts on what the media's role is on reporting on things that are definitely going to be flashpoints. They're definitely going to be divisive. Like this, if we have like any given day, you've got a white police officer that is accused of excessive force on a minority of any sort, you know that's going to be a divisive issue. You know it's going to get a lot of clicks. What's the media's responsibility on how that's reported?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that we've already talked about, so I won't come back to them, as far as the financial incentives on the current business model, which need to get fixed. But also, one of the things I think rarely gets talked about when we talk about what's wrong with how the news media covers conflict is that journalists are captured by the conflict. Like, they are not separate. So they are humans living in the same world you are, except they're consuming way more news, which we know from decades of research is really bad for you, unfortunately. So the more news you consume about politics, especially news about disasters, there's been a lot of research on that, the more likely you are to experience symptoms of post-traumatic stress, the more likely you are to see threat where there isn't one, the more likely you are to make a bunch of mistakes about the other side, whatever that is. And so I think a lot of, not all, but a portion of what we're seeing is because a lot of journalists have been bewitched by the same high conflict that politicians have been bewitched by. And so they're going to react in the same way. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to lose their peripheral vision. They don't talk to people who they disagree with. I mean, it's, you know, and they're incentivized in a lot of cases by their organizations or by Twitter or whatever. So that's a piece of it. I will also say at the same time that there are a lot of journalists I know who are miserable, who really dislike this whole dynamic, who do not want to do harm, who do not want to create clickbait, who actively work to try to do something else. Just like audiences want something else, right? I have, like, the most hope I have is when I talk to large audiences and ask them what they want from the news, because they want to be informed, but they want something different, right? Sometimes data can help us prevent us from making mistakes. And that's something that is important to invest in, right? In newsrooms, to take the example you gave of police shootings and police abuse of force. In the US, again, the place I know best, we by design have not done a good job actually measuring how many people from different races are getting killed by the police. And that's on purpose. That's not because it's impossible, right? And so without that data, you got a bunch of emotion, right? And fear coming into the void, which you would expect, right? So then it's really easy to manipulate people. Now you have to do that data in such a way that people trust it, right? So it would have been good if we started this 20 years ago and if the FBI were doing it and other things. But anyway, data is one way to prevent that, because if you have the data, it may or may not, but it may prevent you from exaggerating or underplaying real threats, right? But another way is to tap into this yearning out there that I see, and the stories I write about that have been most popular, like just gone viral, have been stories that are covering conflict differently, that are not falling into these same traps. Not that I've never done that. I've done that many times, but recently I've tried to do it differently. And I just think there's huge demand out there for that because people are so exhausted, right, by high conflict.
And that's such a great point to leave us on, because it is exhausting, right? And I think as Gen Z comes in and the millennial generation gets older, we've grown up in this alarmist news cycle for the last 20 years, and it existed before that, but I think it seems like in my head, like 9/11 was like the birth of the 24-hour alarmist news cycle, and at least probably from where I started paying attention to the media.
Yeah, and also the phone, right? Like when the iPhone in 2008 became, because now it's just on you. It's at you in every direction all the time, which is new.
Yeah. Well, look, I was in a meeting last week where we all had our phones on the table, right? There's three people having a meeting talking about a new emergency management app thing, and we all got a notification at the same time saying that there was a plane... A fully laden commercial aircraft that had made a mayday call was coming in for landing, and we all just sat there watching the notifications. No, like, I'm not going to catch the plane, right? There's nothing I can do about this. Right. But we're captured by what's going to happen,
right?
And then and then nothing happened for a little bit. So we like periodically we'd all just sort of one person would just like scroll back, still in the air,
right.
Oh, they've landed safely. Okay, I was like, oh, we can go back to the meeting now. But like. Like our ancestors never dealt with that.
Right.
Like we're not wired.
Oh my
for
God,
this,
that's so a great example. So that's a newsworthy thing, right? We can all probably agree that a big passenger airline going down is a tragedy. It's distressing. It probably does deserve coverage. But when, where, how? Those things really matter. Like, do we all need to know instantaneously in the most kind of apocryphal language? Like, how is that helpful? It doesn't help the people on that plane, to your point. Like right? I was reading this great essay that this guy wrote about how he stopped reading the news because it was so depressing. And he said, you know, he'd been consuming a lot of news before this, and he had this kind of magical thinking that maybe by worrying about, say, Ukraine, he was helping. You know, and there's this sense that, like, if I can just feel bad enough and immerse myself in the gritty, raw realities of enough tragedies, I will help. And that is not the case. And anyone who has been through a tragedy will tell you, no thanks. Like, that's not helping me. Now, I guess what I would argue is, let's find ways for people to be helpful, right? If we're gonna subject them to these stories, and let's contain the exposure, so they're not, you know, in the middle of a in-person encounter, as you were, trying to talk about something important, and you get, you know, disrupted in this way, which we all know what that's like.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's so much about the modern world that we're just not built for, and and it's gonna take like a millennia to catch up, and then by that point, everything will be different again. So,
but the first thing you could do is just turn off your notifications.
But
can you do that, or do you feel like maybe you feel like because of your work you can't do that?
I really probably could.
Yeah, like most of us could.
There's very little that I probably need to know about instantaneously.
Right. I've now turned them all off, and I actually don't put my phone out on any tables anymore. Because I was like, there's a study that showed that it like makes people distracted even if you're not looking at it. So like,
there's small things we can do. You've at least got to turn it face down, right?
Right.
Because if someone else's screen lights up, your eyes
go to it. Oh my God, yes, right? Totally.
And now it's like the wearables, like your watch will light up. You're like, I've got to fight the Pavlovian conditioning to check it. You know?
Yes.
Anyway, we're getting sidetracked. But to bring us to a conclusion, what have you got going on next? Like, what are you working on now? Is there another book? What's going on?
Yeah, so I'm doing a bunch of projects just writing about how, you know, covering in print and also in a podcast I host called How To for Slate. We try to cover problems, real problems that people are struggling with, but do it in a way that is helpful. Try to give people some sense of agency, give people something to do by talking to the wisest people we can find and then telling those stories, right? As opposed to just the stories of pain and suffering, which are important, but are pretty well covered at this point. So I'm excited about that. And then I also started a company with a journalist colleague. It's called Good Conflict. And we do really cool experiments in how we cover conflict ourselves to try to figure out if there's a better way. And then we also do workshops for newsrooms and other organizations so that they can learn to go through conflict more deftly and less destructively. And that's a lot of fun. It's very different from anything I've ever done before. So it's been really fun.
Very, very cool. Well, for anyone listening, make sure you check out High Conflict, available everywhere that you normally get books. Excellent read. You need to make sure you pick it up. And Amanda's website is amandaripley.com for any further inquiries. Amanda, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute blast talking to you. And thank you again for a wonderful book. It's definitely gone on my reading list. And I know several people I've already spoken to have bought it. So I always love the fact about books. Like, you never know how much you're changing the world, because you never know who's going to end up reading and getting something out of it. So congratulations on a fantastic book. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Make sure you check out our catalog at www.violencepod.com for more interviews with the world's leading experts in violence prevention, threat assessment, and personal security. If you'd like to support the work I do on the show, please visit www.violencepod.com/support. And if you're interested in booking me or my team to provide training, workshops, or consultation on violence prevention and management, you can visit violencepod.com/training. I look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Until then, stay safe and stay dangerous.